Hello and welcome to the Farm Forum podcast. I'm your host, Jonah Comstock. In the ranks of ubiquitous but ill-defined terms in pharma, precision medicine is up there near the top. So what do we mean when we talk about precision, especially in a discipline like mental health that historically has involved a lot of objectivity? My guest today is Dr. Amit Etkin, founder and CEO of Alto Neuroscience, a recently IPO'd biotech that wants to bring precision medicine to psychiatry. We're going to talk about what that means and how they're doing it. Welcome to the show, Amit.
It's my pleasure to join you.
So first of all, just tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in this field? What's your background and how did you come to start Alto?
So I'm an MD, PhD. I'm a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist and a reformed academic. I spent a decade on faculty at Stanford doing the science that led to Alto. I developed a big lab. I was a tenured full professor, really coming at it from an academic lens, which was, how do we go from broad phenomenology that we currently use to diagnose our patients and take it down to the biology that we can assess on an individual patient level in a scalable way that tells us something about their brain and something about what kind of treatments work? It's only in doing that over and over, different kinds of patients, different kinds of treatments, different kinds of biological tools, that we got to the point about 2017, 2018, where I started to realize that there is a limit to what academia can do on this question, and that the real opportunity is in taking the science that we started to really prove out and make quite robust into the world of drug development, and specifically the idea of creating new treatments by understanding how people differ biologically, which is very, very different from how we've done our drug development in psychiatry in the past. So 2019, I launched Alto, left Stanford, gave up my tenured position. That was November 2019. Didn't quite appreciate that we're going into a pandemic as a first-time CEO with a seed-funded company. That was a bit of a harrowing ride for a while, as we all remember what those times were like. But it's been incredibly rewarding since. We've built a company of now 65, 70 people, as you mentioned, IPO'd this past February, and have a number of programs in the clinic with readouts in the near future, all taking a precision approach. So if you look at that arc and starting as an academic and starting with the science and kind of growing and evolving my ideas of how we go forward based on where the science is and what it's telling us, it's been just incredibly rewarding seeing that come to fruition.
So talk to me a little bit about the approach at Alto and how it's unique compared to maybe other biotechs in this space.
So let's take two anchors, right? Let's take what has happened historically. And by historically, I mean for like the past 50 years, so not a subtle history. And then the other anchor is the term, you know, you mentioned sort of a vague term around precision medicine, which I'd like to ground and say it's the right drug for the right patient at the right time. Like, let's kind of frame it in the simplest terms. That's what precision medicine, I think, most generally means, and certainly what precision psychiatry would mean.
As opposed to one drug for every patient, right?
As opposed to one drug for every patient, or even precision in a different approach, like getting at some molecular target in a more specific way. And that might be an element of precision, but truly precision medicine is how you provide a medication and to whom, and of course, when, because that's a critical part of in treating them. But how have we developed medications in the past as a field? Sadly, all of our medications originated from good observations, from serendipity, but people paying attention and noticing that certain drugs had particular effects, and then harnessing it as a therapeutic for depression, for schizophrenia. And so, you know, our antidepressants came from observations about anti-tuberculosis agents, of all places. And then from there, people have basically tweaked these drugs to create these so-called Me-Too compounds that eventually got us to SSRIs, SNRIs, and so forth, which have not progressed our understanding of the biology at all. They've just been that initial observation evolved. Also, they've been applied to patients irrespective, in fact, never really measuring their biology in the first place. So we take as our kind of classification system, the so-called DSM, or Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And by the way, the statistical part is more on the descriptive aspect of it, is not actually numbers and statistics in the way that we would normally use that term. And in a diagnosis like depression, you could meet with any 5 out of 9 criteria that are all subjective, reported, symptom-based. None of them, even though they want to speak to objective measures like cognition or appetite or sleep, are actually measured objectively. So you have a huge amount of clinical variability. You have no measurement of biological variability, which we know is massive. And so it's perhaps no surprise that when you do a trial and you get one bunch of patients and you get a result, it's really hard to repeat that trial in another bunch of patients when you have no control over who's actually coming into your study, because you're never even measuring biology in the first place. And the thing that comes with it, perhaps also non-surprisingly, is because of that heterogeneity, your actual target population who benefits from the drug is small, but you wash them out with a huge number of people who don't respond to that drug because they don't have the right biology. And so most of your trials will fail. Even Prozac needed 7 trials to get 2 that were positive. And I don't think anybody has the patience at this point in our history to do 7 trials just to get 2 that are positive. So fundamentally, it was not and has not and is still not a good way to progress drugs. It's not a good way to progress our biological understanding of why a drug might work, even if you can get it to eke out an effect in this way. And it's certainly not a good way of finding new drugs and new targets, because it's all a spaghetti throwing exercise and hoping that something sticks.
So the thing about it is that it comes down to biomarkers, right? Like, I think we're also conditioned to think that there is no sort of quantitative marker to say that I have depression or I have ADHD. And in order to kind of change this paradigm, you've got to find those markers, right?
That's right. And you got to define what the markers are to be of, right? So they're not of depression. Depression is a construct that we've used and created since decades past to create an understanding, a common language of a phenomenon, right? That phenomenon is at the end of the road, though. Think of it as an analogy, say, to describing yourself as having a fever disorder, if your phenotype is having a fever. But the fever is not the problem. The problem is the thing that caused the fever. And that's where the biology would be by analogy that we need to get to in psychiatry.
Just I want to hear the rest of the answer, but that cause isn't always biological, right? I mean, it could be trauma. It could be, some kind of effect of, I don't know how you'd describe it, but psychological.
Psychology, in the way that you just framed it, though, is biology, right? It's still an impact on how your brain processes emotional information, cognitive information, how flexible you are at reframing your experiences, like a trauma, for example, to see it as a growth opportunity rather than an example of you being broken by this event. That all has to do with how your brain works. So absolutely, there is biology in genetics, biology is in exposures that you have, and biology is in the environmental, experiential, and, part of our world, which is to also say that we never want to take away from a patient the experience of having mental illness. That is part and parcel of the whole entity. We just need to explain it in terms of the biology that are the parts. So, for example, take cognition. So the ability to think, the ability to remember, the ability to be flexible and adaptive, all of that can be measured objectively, can be grounded in the function of particular brain circuits, and differs across different patients. With, let's just take depression as an example, the same level of symptoms might have completely normal looking cognition or very impaired cognition. And so that's one of those bases. Another one of those bases might be how you process rewarding cues and activities and information. So are you one who benefits from that and drives your motivation for activity and drives your ability to learn and adapt? Or do you not quite have that response to reward, in which case we might call you something more like anhedonic as a way to describe the lack of pleasure and motivation? So those things can be grounded, can be objectively measured, can be mapped onto brain circuitry, the function of different molecular systems within those brain circuits. And that starts to sound like a drug target. So if you can get it down to that level, match it with the right patients who have phenotypes that are addressed by the molecular intervention that alters a circuit that affects a function that eventually maps into part of, let's say, depression is just one example, then you can create a thoroughgoing science that is precision psychiatry.
It's interesting because if you take it outside of the context of mental health, nothing you're saying sounds radical. It just sounds like, oh yeah, that's how we do science, right? But then when you take it in comparison to how drug development in psychiatry has happened and how drugs are prescribed in psychiatry, it sounds completely insane in terms of how different it is, right?
Yeah. And we've wrestled with that in how we, you know, trying to get people to understand what we're doing over and over. And it's exactly as you said, that there are that if you go into an oncology drug development program and you said, I'm going to do an all-comer drug for lung cancer or whatever, pick your tissue, people would laugh at you. It sounds like you actually don't know what you're talking about, because shouldn't you know the biology? And the biology differs by all the molecular phenotypes of a tumor. Yet in psychiatry, exactly as you said, the opposite seems to be true. But there's points to learn from there. So number one is, can we find precision? Can we replicate our ability to find the right patients, show that they have better drug response? We've already done that with standard of care treatments. We've done that for our own treatments. And we're now in late stage trials looking at efficacy. So that's one element there in those biomarker defined patients. But the other element is actually the commercial element and thinking about what the patient would actually want to see happen. And traditionally, commercial programs and pharmas have resisted partitioning the population, but in reality, they are, but they're doing it empirically. So the drugs are given to people non-selectively. It benefits some people who stay on the drug, and that drives your revenue. And then there's a lot of churn amongst the people who are not benefiting. So you actually are, your model is, even if you've not put it in that way mentally, is to find that population, except you're doing it empirically one by one. What if you could find that population by giving them a test that takes, you know, 15, 30 minutes to do, and you get an answer on the spot? And moreover, what if that test could be done by the patient on themselves in their home? That might actually look like a real change in how the practice of psychiatry happens, engaging patients more in that process, being far more deliberate about what a commercialization program looks like. That, to me, feels like it ought to be attractive relative to what we do now. I think we just have to show the world what that path looks like to make it concrete. But as you said, we're taking a page out of other areas of medicine where it's worked quite well.
And even outside of drugs, if we were to make that paradigm shift happen in mental health care towards objective diagnostics, feels like that would have a lot of other positive effects around stigma, you know, because no one says, oh, are you sure you really have lung cancer? But people say, oh, are you sure you're really depressed? Are you sure you really have ADHD? You know, things like that, because the measures are so subjective. And one doctor might say you have one thing and another might say you don't.
That's right. And in fact, you take it to one additional level, which is a very weird oddity in psychiatry, where people keep wanting to come off their drugs. And they keep wanting to come off their drugs with this idea that it's the drug that made me better and not me. But if you can give them an explanatory model of, you have this bit of biology, the drug treats that bit of biology, and that is why you got better. People don't think of needing to come off their insulin because it's their insulin that's keeping their blood sugar under control and not them, right? It's a different mental model that we wrestle with in psychiatry. And, you know, to be frank, as a psychiatrist, I don't blame patients for being frustrated and questioning, you know, do we really know what we're doing in trying to get them treatment? Certainly, doctors are doing their best with the tools that they have, and it's with the best of intentions that they are trying one treatment after another. It's just the lack of tools.
Sure.
But if you did have that, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that trial and error approach isn't invisible to patients. They see that the doctors put them on one thing and then said, "Oh, see how it works, and we'll try something else." And that probably doesn't inspire confidence in every case.
Not in the least, right? And people drop out of treatment. People are non-compliant with their medications. There's a lot of things that happen. And to me, it all comes down to just feeling like the system is logical, that there is a reason why something would happen and that they need to stay on the drug and that they have an explanation for why they got better. And all of that fits nicely with the idea in a precision psychiatry framing that you can roll all the way back to how the drugs are developed, because the problem that we have now in the clinic derives from how we develop the drugs in the lack of precision. If you take the ultimate situation you're trying to create in the clinic of actually taking a test and either knowing that that's the right drug for you or knowing that that's not the right drug for you, which is equally important information if you're negative on that test, right? And now roll that back into drug development, you should be able to increase the odds of success in drug development. So you're looking for bigger effects than your all-comer unselected population. If you don't see that, if you can't enrich your population with a biomarker to find the right people, then maybe you shelve that program because it's just not developable in a robust way. And so you save money on the programs that are less successful, you put it to the programs that are more successful. And because they have a bigger effect, they should be more likely to work in subsequent phases of development and then differentiate from having, well, you know, the competition really being a generic drug, because there's so many generics out there, that's a trial and error drug. So all of that really benefits from starting at the top and then rolling all that different perspective through.
And then are these objective measures that are, you know, used for finding the right patients and finding the right drugs for patients, does that also have an effect on study design when it comes to endpoints? Because endpoints can be very fuzzy in psychiatric studies too.
So they are fuzzy, but they are face valid at the same time. And this is an area where I think some incrementalism and sort of thinking about what are we really wanting to innovate on first is important. So we know from the FDA, they've made clear in their guidances in the past that there's a couple of measures that, for example, in depression, they accept. And those are measures of symptoms. Now, for all of their flaws as measures, and we know well those flaws, they were created back in the 70s and 80s. A lot has changed since then in our understanding of even how to measure symptoms. They still measure something that the patient experiences and is face valid. That is at least an element of the patient's day-to-day life. And so the innovation is, in a precision psychiatry lens, choosing the right patients for whom you're getting at the biology in the right way with a drug and therefore seeing an effect on symptoms. However, that's a first point. I think from there, you can start thinking about different ways that biology can actually give you either endpoint changes themselves, or perhaps even more likely, the ability to know with early studies that you do on biological endpoints, whether you're likely to ultimately transition to hitting clinical endpoints. So these ideas that you'd see in other fields like surrogate or proxy biomarkers, and if you look at an area like oncology and immunology and other areas where there is a very clear understanding of those biomarkers, even in a late phase one, early phase two study, you might get enough information to tell you, I think we're really on the right path here. That doesn't exist in psychiatry at all now, but what if we measure the biomarkers that we can relate to clinical change ultimately early on? And we do it in larger phase one studies where we're really understanding dose response. We're really doing the selection of indications of targets based on information. That's part of what we're also doing at Alto. And if you do that repeatedly, then you can get the output of that information to then map onto your ultimate clinical trials and then bring all of that learning back to the next program and over repeat this until you get predictability in how you develop drugs. So if you don't impact the brain on these targets early on, maybe you don't bring that drug forward. But if you do impact the brain, then it allows you to select the dose, select the indication, make everything more likely to work, much more precise and targeted when you get to the clinical realm.
I'm thinking about what you said at the beginning about Prozac and how it was developed. It seems like this, once you kind of prove the concept, this would be very attractive for other drug developers to follow you down this path, because that can't have been cheap for them to do 7 studies and show an effect in 2.
That's right. Nobody wants to fail, right? I mean, you'd like to think that they would all want to find a better way, a different path to success. You know, our lens at Alto is first and foremost our own drugs. That's why we built a pipeline multiple clinical stage assets going after different subpopulations and different disorders in new ways. So as you mentioned, we have results coming up for several big trials. We have four phase twos ongoing or planned, but two of them are phase 2Bs, prospectively selecting patients in large samples, one using a cognitive measure for Alto 100 in depression, another one using an EEG measure for Alto 300, a different subpopulation in depression. And depending on how those look, absolutely, they can and should guide others' behavior. Some companies, I think, would see that and start following, and imitation being the highest form of flattery, we'll take that as a real positive and endorsement of this approach. We don't anticipate that we'll be, doing the entirety of the only people doing precision psychiatry. And others will take more iterations probably before they really reorient, but at least we would have changed imagination. And I think we've seen that in other areas of innovation, especially in the tech world, where you need somebody to change imagination. The analogy here is like EVs. Big, Detroit automakers could have created EVs ages ago. There's no fundamental reason why they couldn't have. But it ultimately required startups like Tesla, which eventually became large itself, right? Creating that, showing what's possible. And now it's just something that you wash through the entire system, and all the major automakers are doing it. And I think the same approach will happen in precision psychiatry, because we all need to solve these problems. These are major, highly prevalent, highly disabling diseases with very little in the way of new treatments. So we need a new approach, and success in a new approach, I'm betting, will beget a wave of this kind of work, and that will ultimately benefit patients massively.
What's the line? And I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but it's just occurred to me as sort of a possible tricky ground or criticism here. What's the line between precision medicine and cherry picking your subjects, right? Because if you're doing a bunch of vetting on the front end of your clinical trial, from the outside, that might just look like, you're trying to pick out the patients who are going to do well so that it looks more effective than it is. It's almost like a different way to frame what we've been talking about.
Yeah. So first of all, when you do select patients, you've got to make sure that you're doing this prospectively and that you're really replicating prospectively, which we've done in all of our trials to date. Whenever we identify a biomarker, we have a separate group of patients that we then test that we've not touched at all, that we test prospectively, did using the biomarker in fact enrich for a bigger clinical response. But as you do your trials, as you think of what the ultimate approved drug might look like in terms of how it's used, you of course are trying to find the people who benefit. That is exactly the point, right? You have to understand this, I suppose, as a contrast or as a broader question, this question of where is our ground truth? Is our ground truth a diagnosis that was created in the 60s and 70s? Built on a bunch of symptoms that you can have different constellations of, and that we're picking out of that? Or is that a background? And our ground truth is actually the biology that we're measuring on the individual person. And that's a better way to really anchor. I think over time, as we see these precision approaches work, that's how we will transition, and people's thinking will transition from my Bible, as it's been termed in terms of the DSM, says depression is my thing, and how could you partition that? Isn't that cherry picking in the words you use, right? To how could we ever have thought something that happens in 6 or 7% of humanity at any one time is one disease? I can actually measure cognition. I can actually measure brain activity with EEG. I can actually look at reward systems. That is actually my grounding. And of course, if I took this hodgepodge, it just wouldn't make sense. That's how oncology, for example, has evolved in its thinking. And I would expect data, essentially, with a precision approach to be the driver of a change in thinking for our own field.
So you're getting at something else in that answer that I wanted to touch on. There is a sort of a fraction in mental health care between the prescribers and the non-prescribers, the psychiatrists, the talk therapists, right? And I feel like that kind of is fueled by and fuels this sort of persistent idea that mental health is somehow unmeasurable biologically, you know, compared to other conditions. How does that part of the industry, I mean, how do you see them kind of responding to the sorts of changes that we're talking about and we're proposing? What's the role that they still have to play when we start to frame mental health more and more in terms of biology?
So there's a couple of elements there to touch on. I think number one, and this goes back to something I mentioned before, we never want to take the experiential away. And a big part of psychotherapy is just understanding the experiential and working with that. Psychotherapy is an effective treatment. There's no doubt about it. We're definitely not looking to put psychotherapists out of work. I think there's a huge role in clinical care for psychotherapy. Simultaneously, we're also trying to make sure that the people that we're targeting with new medications aren't benefiting already from something that's existing, because just from a drug development process itself, you don't really want to develop a drug that could be replaced by something like a generic drug, certainly, but even by talk therapy. I think it's also important to appreciate that part of the biggest problem with psychotherapy is actually access more than anything else, that most people don't really have access to high quality psychotherapy or enough of it just based on how our health system works. That all said, psychotherapy is just as biological at its core as a medication intervention. So we have published in my work at Stanford, EEG machine learning based predictors of psychotherapy. So we had one paper, for example, in post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, where two dominant types of therapy are used, one that's a cognitive therapy and one that's an exposure therapy. So exposure therapy, the idea is you just sort of experience it, you know, you put yourself into the experience of the trauma and retell that, the narrative of that trauma until you master it. And then cognitive therapy, you're working with how you're thinking and it relates to the trauma to adapt your thought pattern. We could predict if you respond to those therapies using EEG, developed in the same way as we're developing different EEG predictors for our drugs. But what's even more interesting there is we could find a predictor for one therapy, and it turns out to predict the other therapy equally well. So we're actually understanding the biology of psychotherapy at the same time as we're understanding the biology of a new medication. All of it fits in the same rubric. There's no sort of guild level conflict between the psychopharmacologists and psychotherapists. We're all working with the brain at the end. And some people need one thing and other people need another.
So this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I think when I got the pitch, I thought it was interesting, and the nuance that you've injected into it in this conversation has made it, I think, even more interesting to me. Is there anything we haven't touched on yet that you think is an important piece of the puzzle for folks to kind of understand what you're doing here?
Yeah, so I think there's two things that I want to touch on. One is this idea that if you have a new science, we're talking about precision being, if you will, a new science, that you're basically starting from scratch, that you have to create, you have to find new targets, to develop new drugs to enable this new future. And I just don't think that that's true, because the one thing that differs radically between psychiatry and oncology is that we actually have drugs available to start deploying against this. That's how we put our pipeline together at Alto, that we know target interesting proteins, interesting drug targets in different molecular systems in different brain circuits that have just not been leveraged the right way, sometimes not leveraged at all, and never with an understanding of the population you're trying to treat. So these drugs have been brought through phase one or sometimes later development. So we know they're safe in humans. Now we just need to find out which humans with which diseases and which kind of outcomes. That's a lot faster progress to actually clinically useful outcomes than in oncology, where if you find the biology and the driver mutation, you now have to create a new drug against it and you're starting from scratch. So I think that's a very different starting point for the field. That's a very much more optimistic view of how we progress, I think, than the default, like we've got to go bottom up and rebuild this whole thing from scratch. And the other facet that comes along with it is, you know, we have, as I mentioned, four phase two trials that will all read out by the end of 2025. And two of them are late stage, large phase 2Bs. Two of them are smaller proof of concepts, different populations. We'll see pretty soon. And to me, that's incredibly exciting. The process of drug development and the process of going from science to actually something that impacts the clinic is so long. We'll start getting answers soon. And if you're a patient or a loved one of a patient who's itching to get something new and different, we're not talking about 10, 20 year horizons. We're talking about something hopefully much shorter. And that too is a more optimistic angle, even as we do something that really is brand new within psychiatry.
So just to clarify what the first thing that you said, it's both and. There will be new drugs that come out of this because we have new targets to target. But also, we already know that some drugs work for some people and not for others. And having this framework will help us understand which ones and why, and prescribe those existing drugs more precisely. Do I have it right?
Yeah, partially. I think there is certainly the potential that existing approved drugs could be prescribed more precisely. I think that is much more of a challenge to implement because it's just a commercially very different model to go after. I'm talking more about that there are drugs in development that have been created and validated against a target and brought through human safety studies. So we know that they're ready to go into the clinic. We just don't know where and don't know for whom. That's the roster, the sort of bench, if you will, of molecular options that we have to leverage, that we have been leveraging. That's how we created our pipeline at Alto, as we looked for the right drugs, starting with an understanding of who the right people were and what their phenotypes were and what the sort of the brain markers that we wanted to anchor on, and then brought drugs that we could directly go into phase two with. And that means a much faster process if you orient yourself to a precision approach. So having a new lens on the world allows you to start looking at opportunities out there differently. And therefore, big part of the change that has to happen is simply a change in orientation to having a precision lens, because then you'll realize there's actually quite a lot of opportunity around. And then over time, we'll get to entirely new targets, entirely new drugs, but we have a lot to work with that could benefit patients over the short term.
So you're talking about unleashing drugs that have effectively been sitting on the shelf.
Yeah, because even the drugs that you see people create new molecular entities for, or the new molecular entities are targeted at certain proteins that have been the subject of lots and lots of other drug development in the past. All they're doing is just creating a new molecule for IP reasons mainly. They're not creating new science. And so the targets that we think about now as a field, we've been thinking about for 20 or 30 years, and we've been designing various drugs around. So take those targets, take the drugs that hit those targets, new or on the shelf, doesn't really matter, and bring them forward in this way. There's not much that I'm seeing out there that is like a brand new target that nobody's ever thought of and never targeted before. We're just rehashing. So let's take a different lens on it. Take that advantage of that opportunity of having drugs that can go into humans quickly, and you know, let's get some real results.
It really is an illustration of the power of sort of questioning conventional wisdom.
Exactly right. I mean, it is ultimately a lens on the world that changes, and you can attribute some of these changes to changes in machine learning and availability of data and amount of data and so forth. But I think the biggest factor, to be perfectly blunt, is just seeing the world differently. And then when you have that different perspective, immediately opportunities open themselves up.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a great note to end on. I really appreciate your time, Dr. Etkin. Really fascinating stuff. And I'll be excited to see when these sort of proof points start really coming to fruition.
As will I, eagerly awaiting those. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
That concludes this episode of the Pharma Forum podcast. You can find more information about this episode, including a download link and information about other installments in the series, at pharmaforum.com/podcast. The Pharma Forum podcast is also available on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, Stitcher, and Podme, where you can find and subscribe by searching for Pharma Forum. And don't forget to visit our website, where you can sign up for daily news and analysis bulletins, and to follow us on Twitter at @PharmaForum. Thanks for listening.